Hello, I'm John Kelly, and this is a podcast of Mystery Train. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than in the original programme. Mystery Train hits the rails Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on RTE Lyric FM. This is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM. John Kelly here until 9 o'clock. And as we tend to do on many of our Sunday nights, we invite a guest in to pick the tunes. And tonight, I'm delighted to say, it's Mel Mercier, who is a percussionist and much more. Mel, it's great to have you here.
Great, John. Great to be here.
I mean, percussionist, what should we call you? Because, you know, it's more than that.
Well, a lot of the things that I make music from, I do hit.
Yes.
So I suppose percussionist is pretty good.
Right, well, that's the starting point. You do hit things. But you're also a composer.
Yeah.
And the first thing I should do is congratulate you on winning for, I think, the second time now, the Irish Times Award for Best Soundscape. That was for the Gar San Lazar production, wasn't it?
That's right. That was for, well, thank you very much, first of all. That was for the Gar San Lazar production of Beckett's How It Is, Part 1. Which is part one of three. How It Is a dense, intriguing, confounding prose work of Beckett's, and Gar San Lazar, which is really Judy Hegarty Lovett and Connor Lovett, have really made a career out of staging Beckett's works, and in particular the prose works. And so I spent 3 years working with them on this particular production. We made it in the Everyman in Cork, and we turned the Everyman inside out and upside down. Judy Hegarty Lovett did an extraordinary job. And
at some point tonight, Mel, I'd love to ask you how you go about that. You know, when you're commissioned or whatever happens in terms of a play, and what you do and how you go. I think that would be interesting for us to hear about. I also want to talk to you, and I know a lot of our listeners will want to hear about your time working with John Cage.
Sure.
And Merce Cunningham and all of that.
Yeah, yeah.
That'd be quite extraordinary. But just before we get into all of that, Mel, your dad, very, very well-known musician, Pater Mercier, was with the Chieftains way back.
That's right.
And on all the very best of the Chieftains albums at that.
I think that's right. My father, Pater, played on 4 Chieftains albums, Chieftains 2, 3, 4 and 5. And I think that Chieftains 4 and Chieftains 5 are arguably the best traditional ensemble albums that have ever been made. And I think they really, really stand the test of time. I play them every so often for students in lectures, and I always get extraordinarily excited by them. I'm sort of fascinated by the inventiveness of them. At that time in the 1970s, Dad played with the Chieftains from 1966 to 1976. And that coincided with the time that, for a period of that anyway, that he played with Sean O'Riordan and Ceoltóirí Chulainn. And I remember those albums coming into the house, the Chieftains albums.
And of course, the design, those Delaney covers were beautiful as well.
Absolutely beautiful.
The whole thing seemed to be so well thought out, so well planned, everything about it. And in those days when so much was kind of through other, this was sort of special, I think.
Yeah, I think it was special. When I listen back now to the Ceoltóirí Chulainn recordings and then listen to the Chieftains recordings side by side, you can really hear the shift in production values. I absolutely love the O'Riordan CDs. I love O'Riordan Seagate. I mean, there's something magical about that, and capturing the energy of that with all of its flaws and everything is a total gift. But when you listen to the Chieftains albums, which are really studio albums, and that introduction, for example, in Chieftains 4 of stereo, and they were pristine, and the tuning is pristine, and of course the arrangements really are kind of genius, I think. And so it was terribly exciting, and I would sit at home with my father, and we'd listen, and we'd sit side by side playing 2 Barons together and play along with the tracks. And indeed, then when the Chieftains would perform that those new albums in concert, I often got to sit with my father at home to practice the rhythms. Wonderful. Because one of the extraordinary things that was happening, and I've heard lots of commentary about this. I spoke to Michael Tuberty about it, about that period. This was really challenging material for the musicians as well.
Was it?
Oh, it was. Right. I mean, these orchestrations and these kind of arrangements that Maloney and the group were doing were very, very challenging for them. So Dad needed to practice them at home before the concerts. And I really had the privilege of sitting and working them out with them.
Well, You've brought in a really interesting running order here, and I'm going to depart from it almost immediately, if you don't mind, because after that conversation, we should probably hear, and I was going to say the Chieftains, but we should probably hear O'Riordan first, so, which will make more sense. And I think everybody will know what you're talking about when they hear this one. And there's O'Neill's March there from Kiltory Coolin with Pater Mercier on Baron, and Pater's son Mel is my guest tonight, picking all the tracks. What's it sound like to you now to hear that? Because you wouldn't have known O'Riordan, I suspect. You would have been too young.
I never met him. Yeah, I was about, in 1969, I was 10. And I don't think there had been too many concerts, in fact, before 1969. In the earlier years, we grew up in Black Rock, and my parents' house was in Black Rock, and O'Riordan had a house up in Galloping Green, which is only 10 minutes walk from the house. So I know that Dad would have spent some time up there, and of course there are all sorts of wonderful stories about the sessions in that house, you know, musicians and poets and actors. But I never got to meet O'Riordan myself. But I always felt a very strong presence of him. And ours actually wasn't a house which was, in that sense, you know, in that traditional mould where there were musicians coming in, mm-hmm. coming in and out all the time. It was too full. There were 10 children already in the house. And it's a dormer bungalow in Black Rock. And of course, my father came quite late to music. He was in his 40s.
Is that right?
Yeah, he really came to music through the Irish language. Mm. That really was his first love. I mean, his given name was Herbert Peter Mercer. And
wow.
When he turned west, in a way, I mean, originally family roots up in Northern Ireland. And when he turned west and towards the Irish language, he changed his name to Pather. And then slowly but surely, in a way that still remains quite mysterious to us, the name Mercer became Mercier. The whole other side of his family are still Mercers.
Oh.
So we're the Merciers in that mix.
Must have been a great time where you could change your name literally, because I don't think people would let you away with that now.
Well, you see, it's a very interesting thing, because I've come to realise more and more that Daddy really was his own invention. Mm. I mean, he really did invent himself. Well, I mean, he did. Daddy worked for Crampton's the Builders. We called them Crampton's the Builders. He was a site foreman for a period of time, and then he ran the materials shop in Crampton's in Ballsbridge. So he was the one who gave out all of the tools and all the nails and. It was while he was working there that he met Sean O'Riordan. He was introduced to Sean O'Riordan by Eamon Butler.
Mm-hmm.
And really, his life kind of changed in that moment. But he was ready for that change, because he, in a sense, had already reinvented himself.
And when he met O'Riordan, did he have in his possession at that time a Baron?
He did. He did have a Baron, because he had recently begun to play the Baron, because he was drawn through the Irish language then into Fla Ceolls, for example, and into all sorts of Irish music, folk music contexts.
Yeah.
When O'Riordan set up Kiltory Coolin, which was a couple of years later, of course, O'Riordan led Kiltory Coolin, and not a lot of people realise this, he led it with the Baron. And It was only later that he moved to the harpsichord. So in fact, Ohrida brought the Bowron onto the concert stage in his own hands and really single-handedly on the back of John B. Keane's character of Carthalon, the Scythe in Scythe, who play the Bowron. Between the two of them, they really lifted the Bowron into a kind of national consciousness, a kind of awareness of it that it had never had before.
I was just going to say that I don't think most people had even seen one. Because all the sessions that I was aware of, or all the musicians I heard local people talking about, there was never any mention of a Bowron at all.
No,
ever.
I don't think you... I mean, you could hear the Bowron once a year on St. Stephen's Day.
Yeah.
For the Wren Hunt.
But I'm sure it wasn't played particularly well. It was just battered, really, wasn't it? In that circumstance.
In that circumstance, of course, it was like a processional instrument as well. So it was used outdoors, and my understanding is that there were maybe multiple Bowrons played, sometimes with a stick, sometimes with the back of the hand. So there's a whole tradition up in Sligo Roscommon, for example, of a wonderful and really sophisticated hand playing tradition. One of the great exponents of that is the flute player Seamus Tansey, and he would have played for the Mummers and for the Wren. So the Bowron, the playing of it at that time wasn't very sophisticated, but like on that recording that we've just heard of Ohrida the Sagaity, the way my father played, which is actually a kind of echo of that old world. It's an open sound, it's kind of got a majestic kind of momentum to it. Mm. It was tamed later. With the chieftains, it became kind of a concert instrument, and so it had to be sort of tamed and domesticated a little bit, I suppose, to become to make that transition from what was like a domestic farm implement, in that was used as a sieve on the farm. You know, it made that transition in the 1950s, 60s, and went onto the concert stage and became a musical instrument.
So when you look at the way a Bowron is played nowadays. And, you know, you think of the great players like Ringo and all those people.
Absolutely.
That would have really come from the Chieftain's records and your father, I suspect.
Oh, yeah.
That whole style of playing.
Oh, it did. I mean, I think my father inspired an awful lot of those younger players, Ringo and then Tommy Hayes. And I meet people all the time from America, for example, who will say that they began to play the Bowron when they first saw my father play with the Chieftains in Carnegie Hall, for example. You know, that really was the inspiration for many, many people.
Now, I want to get into your music and what you do yourself, but just I suppose we should play the Chieftains now after that. And you were talking earlier on about you'd sit at home with your dad playing along with the Chieftains records. Well, I did the same with this one. I didn't have a Bowron, but anything that was available, the sight of a book or whatever, and this tune that you picked was always the one. Always the one. The Morning Dew from the Chieftains, from the album The Chieftains 4, which is still the most amazing record. And Mel Mercier is with me in studio tonight picking all the tracks, and he picked that one. His dad, Patter's, playing on that. And that's 73, 4, sometime around then.
Yeah, I think
then.
That's 73 or 74.
So picture the scene then for us in Black Rock in the 70s, early 70s, and that album is out and it's cool. And, you know, the Chieftains are so cool and they're on top of the pops.
They're on top of the pops. And that was an extraordinary moment for me and for my siblings, because at that time... I have 9 brothers and sisters, and they all have their own musical favourites and things. At the time, I was mostly listening to T-Rex and Slade, which I now understand in hindsight was kind of the beginning of glam rock. I didn't realise that at the time. And I'm also curious then about my own interest later, slightly later interest then, in Horselips. I was fascinated, absolutely adored Horselips. So
they were also glam rock.
That's serious glam rock. But I that's what I was into. And we, of course, Top of the Pops was our kind of weekly pilgrimage into the charts, you know, and into the British music charts. And then suddenly, bang, this album comes out of the Chieftains 4, and a single. And with the time of singles, of course. And this track, The Morning Dew, which I think is perhaps the first Chieftains track that really showed off its studio credentials, because they were now recording in London, and because this has stereo, and it has one Baron in the left speaker and one Baron in the right speaker, and it also has a fade out, which at the time were kind of, you know, remarkably untraditional things to listen to on a record. And when that album came into our house, this is before the Chieftains went on Top of the Pops, we had a good stereo player. I think we may have had the first stereo player in our on our road in Arda Park in Blackrock. And my father had a couple of those wonderful albums, which were to show off the stereo. So you had tracks that had a train, for example, moving from the right speaker through the left speaker, or you had percussion things with all the drums panned hard left and right. And my friends would come to the house to listen to recordings, and my father would line us up directly in the middle of the speakers. Not splayed out, but actually one person sitting behind the other with your kind of legs straddling them around the back, so that everybody would have the perfect stereo image. And so this was the Morning Dew then was really the track that once the Chieftains appeared on Top of the Pops, and subsequently, actually, which was even cooler for us at the time, was the Old Grey Whistle Test. Then we knew we were into serious music territory. That was the moment, really, when our world of love for traditional music the world that my father had opened up to us, and the world that I shared with my friends of Top of the Pops and all the wonderful music on that, that's really when they came together. And I think it probably coincides as well with the Chieftains really crossing over. You know, this was the time when Mick Jagger and Linda Ronstadt and all of those other huge rock stars were beginning to align themselves, associate themselves with, be seen in photographs with, talk about in their interviews, the Chieftains. Mm. And there was an extraordinary sense of pride, I think, for us around that time.
Well, thanks for sharing all that with us. I mean, what a rich background to have, you know, and your dad's so involved. I mean, even to have played on O'Neill's March, it's an iconic piece of music, you know. And it's funny, you got into Horslip later on as well, who turned it into another piece of iconic music in Jarrig Doom. Now, let's get into your own musical choices, and let's just kick off with the first one that's on your list here, I see.
Yeah.
Now, the work that you do in Limerick, we'll talk about that specifically, what it is, but Mel, at the moment now you are Professor of Performing Arts at UL, on all the wonderful facilities that are there, and we want to talk about that. You specialise in Irish music, obviously, but also ethnomusicology, Javanese gamelan, Indian classical music, Ghanaian drumming, all sorts, and I want to talk about how you got into all those things. Before we do that, will you introduce the first piece of music that's on your list, Ayub Ogada? What is that?
So Ayub Ogada is an African musician that I came across actually in Cork while I was still at UCC. And at that time when the lobby bar really was the mecca, upstairs in the lobby bar was the mecca for traditional music, but also world music and folk music. And Ayub Ogada appeared on the programme. I've no idea how he got there, I really don't know how he ended up there, but I went along, and he played a small lap harp, and had some bells, ankle bells, and a little string from the ankle bells tied onto his big toe, onto his bare feet. And he was his own percussionist. So he kept these beautiful syncopated polyrhythms going between his feet and his two hands on the harp. And then this glorious voice. And subsequently got an album of his. And this track, Cote Biro, I think is probably the best known track on it. But the reason I've chosen it actually is because my wife, Maura O'Keefe, and I played this album over and over and over again when our daughter, after our daughter was born, and for the first few years. And so it's really reminiscent of that kind of magical, really, really precious time that we had with her. Her name's Nora Kate. And Nora Kate, I don't think, remembers. She's 10 now. She doesn't quite remember Io Bogada, but we're kind of hoping that some of this has gone into her cells.
Oh, that's gorgeous, Mel. Absolutely beautiful. Io Bogada, Kenyan musician.
Yeah, Kenyan musician. And in fact, he died very recently. He died on the 1st of February this year.
Mm.
I think that's on Real World Records. He was a real world recording artist. My understanding is that he wasn't really appreciated to the same degree at home.
See, when you mentioned a label like Real World, I remember when those records started to come out, and there was also the Virgin Earthworks label, which brought out a lot of the South African music. And those of us who were into music, you know, went down those roads, and we were discovering this music for the very first time. It's particularly the stuff on Real World. They were bringing out great records from Pakistan and from India and from all over Africa, all sorts of places. Were you already listening to what was known as world music before these albums started to appear on the scene?
My introduction to world music really began, I would say, in the late 1980s. In 1989, after I graduated from an undergraduate music degree in Cork, I went to California. I got a Fulbright scholarship at the time to go to California to study a master's in world music at the California Institute of the Arts in LA. And that's when I first discovered West African A-way dance drumming, for example, Javanese gamelan, South Indian percussion, North Indian music. And I really fell into it. I went there as a Bowron player, and I did a degree, what they actually called after the 2 years, they said it was a Master's of Fine Arts in World Music Percussion. Now, I think they made up that title for me. CalArts is an extraordinary place, a very, very liberal university.
But what took you down that road, Mel? I mean, you considered yourself a Bowron player.
Yeah.
So why didn't you just join a band?
Well, what took me down the road was that I, in UCC between 1986 and 1989, I was introduced to a subject called ethnomusicology, which is really the academic study of traditions of music throughout the world. And I was introduced to musics really through lectures that were given at that time by Micheál Asuluwan. And of course, Micheál was leading the development of academic studies in Irish traditional music, but he was also himself beginning to embrace the ethnomusicological perspective on things. And so I think, I can't exactly remember this, but I think Micheál may have been the first person, for example, to play some Javanese court gamelan as part of one of his lectures, or some North Indian classical music. And because I was a percussionist, I was particularly drawn to those traditions of very sophisticated, very old practices, for example, of like North Indian tabla, which just blew my mind when I heard it. I couldn't understand that. The thing is that the Bowron is such a new instrument that, and back in the 1980s, was still, hadn't quite found its place amongst the sort of wider global family of traditional percussion. I mean, it's a frame drum like you find in many, many traditions in the Middle East and in India and throughout the world. But it wasn't really quite yet a member of that family. And so when I began to hear these recordings of all these extraordinary drummers and these extraordinary musics, I was immediately drawn to it. When I got the opportunity to go to CalArts, to immerse myself in that and to learn it. I mean, of course, I grabbed that opportunity. And I went and I spent 2 years effectively sitting on the floor, I don't think I read a book while I was there. It was all practice. And so I would roll out of bed in the morning onto the ground, my tabla were set up, I'd sit and I'd play for a few hours. I was getting lessons from an extraordinary teacher, an older tabla player called Tarnath Rao, who actually died while I was there. And I had never played the tabla before. I went to CalArts with jig rhythms and reel rhythms. And that's what I brought with me. Now, they celebrated that. They absolutely loved that. But the complexity and the sophistication of North Indian and South Indian rhythms was far, far, far beyond that. Mm. And then I had this master teacher. So Tarnath Rao, who was coming to the end of his life, was really anxious to share all of his knowledge. And so in my few lessons that I had with him, I amounted a huge amount of, accrued a huge amount of material, which I still can't play, actually, because it was just way beyond me. But I'd sit at the tabla for a couple of hours every morning. Then I'd get up, I'd go down the hall, and for the first time in my life, when I went to CalArts, I found myself sitting in amongst the instruments of the Javanese gamelan. And sitting there teaching was a man called K.R.T. Wasitodinengrat. And K.R.T. Wasitodinengrat, his name before that was K.R.T. Wasitodipuro. He was the head of the court music in Central Java, and one of the most revered musicians and composers in Indonesia. He was teaching at CalArts. Wasitodipuro is the name that he got from the Sultan, which means musician of the world. When some of his music was put on that rocket that was sent off with the music of Mozart and all those, and some of his music was on there, that was sent off into wherever it's gone. And the Sultan changed his name to Wasitodinengrat, which means musician of the universe.
Wow.
So he was sitting there. And so I that was my introduction to Javanese gamelan. And the same was true of West African drumming. There were two brothers, Alfred and Kobla Ladzekpo, two master drummers, one of whom taught me how to sing and one of whom taught me how to drum and how to dance. So it was an extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary experience.
Can we play something now, Mel, that sort of represents that time? I guess something from this album you have here. Tell me about this CD, South Indian Drumming.
So this is a CD by a South Indian percussionist called Trichy Shankaran. And in South India, there is an ensemble drumming tradition called Talavadya. Now, there you find drum ensembles in different parts of the world, like in West Africa, like Samba, for example, in Latin America. We don't have anything here in the Irish tradition that's equivalent to that. But in South India, you have these Talavadya ensembles. They have several different kinds of drums. So they've got a small drum called Kanjira, which is made from lizard skin. They have the two-handed drum, which is like the mother drum, called Mridangam. They have a clay pot called Gautam. And they have this extraordinary tradition of reciting the drum compositions that they then play on the instruments. And that's called Konakol. And this track features some Konakol and then the drumming versions of the spoken syllables.
Now, which track do you want from this?
So this will be track 5.
Okay. And people will, I think people listening will have heard on records here and there, and it's made its way into all sorts of places, that Takatadum, I can't do it, but obviously you're a master at it, but that Takatadum thing.
First of all, I'm not a master at it.
When I shouldn't use the word master.
No, you must not.
Yes, not the word master.
I'm not a master of anything, but if you, when you hear Trichy Shankaran, you'll realise that I'm not. But the, people will be familiar, for example, with Sheila Chandra's extraordinary, seductive, colourful versions of this. But basically, these are syllables like Tadi genatom, which correspond to different sounds on the drum. So the beginning composition on this one, for example, is ta di tadi genatom, ta di tadi genatom, ta di tadi genatom, ta di kita takatari genatom, ta di tadi genatom, ta di tadi genatom, ta di tadi genatom, ta di kita takatari genatom, ta tongu tadi gen atom tongu tongu tadi gen atom tongu 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 tadi gen atom ta, and so on.
And to do the purpose of that is what? Is it to communicate to another musician what the drum rhythm is, or is it a story in itself?
Now, of course, these are nonsense syllables. They're called bols, so they have no meaning. It's a way of learning these very complex rhythmic compositions. They're like rhythmic tunes. So, in fact, this is a way of actually embodying or getting the compositions into you. And then it's used as in performance as well, as a kind of vocal music.
Okay, let's hear it. Here it comes. So, Mel, that's extraordinary. And
in fact, I'm teaching a version of this to my students at the moment, the world music students and the MA ethnomusicology
Imagine
students
getting
at
that
UL.
For your homework. Yeah, that would put manners on you, I'd say.
It was only when I came back to Ireland and from about 1991, 92, I began to teach in Cork. At that time, Micheál Osuluon had begun to make the A River of Sound series. And so he was taking some sabbatical leave. And I was very fortunate to be able to go back into UCC and to teach for like 6 months. And of course, the stuff I taught was the stuff that was really fresh in me, which was all this music that I'd learned in CalArts. But interestingly, there were no instruments.
Yeah, well, I mean, exactly. There must have been people saying, well, why? This is all well and good, but what is the point in this guy teaching this music? What is the point in him even knowing how to play it, really, apart from for himself?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure there were people who were thinking that. But of course, the students loved it.
Mm. Did they respond to it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. They loved it. And they particularly loved it then when we started to actually play the music. So in 1994, when Micheál left UCC to go and take up the chair of music in UL, I took his job. I got his job then I applied for it. I didn't just take it, but in 1994. And one of the first things that I asked for was that we would buy a Javanese gamelan. So I went to Java, and the university agreed at the time. I went to Java and had a new set, a beautiful set of bronze instruments made and shipped over. And the students began to play Javanese gamelan. So the kind of theoretical and historical stuff that I was able to share with them in the couple of years before that really became real for them when the instruments were in the room, and got them also went to, I went to Java for a few years after that, studying myself. I went to West Africa, to Ghana, and I learned some more Awe dance drumming and began to teach that as well. And I was also teaching the South Indian vocal percussion as well. So that's really when it came alive. And what's extraordinary about that is that UCC at that time, and indeed the same is true now in UL, where I do similar kind of teaching. What you have, for example, sitting on the floor in the gamelan room is, you know, the traditional fiddle player and the box player, and also the singer-songwriter and the dancer now in UL, for example, and the pianist or the step dancer. And so they're all, at the singers, they're all finding a new way of sharing music together, because gamelan, for example, or all these ensemble traditions are really great ways to generate what we sometimes call like co-presence, because you're in a room together and everybody is part of the same vibration. And so the students really, really took to that. And so that whole side of world music really blossomed and kind of exploded in a way.
So then, of course, we need to talk about Micheál Osuluon, because I'd say I don't know. Without Micheál being around, you might have had nobody to play with.
Yeah.
Or very few people to play with.
Well, yeah, although, I mean, of course, Micheál was my duet partner, I suppose, in many ways. But there were other people, of course, who were beginning to play with rhythm. I'm thinking of people like Niall Vallely, for example, who were beginning tune players, who were beginning to tune into. syncopation, and now, of course, you know, that it's kind of pervasive in traditional music, especially new traditional music. But Micheál was very interested in music from different parts of the world. And one of the early things he did, I mean, my introduction to Micheál was when I was about 14. I was in the studios here in RTE. Tony McMahon brought me in to do some signature tune music with Micheál for the Long Note, traditional folk music program. And so I came in and Micheál was doing these extraordinary arrangements. He was playing harpsichord. But the other thing that he was playing was a little African thumb piano, a little imbira. Mm-hmm. And I was fascinated by that. And of course, the thing about the African imbira is that it's at least 50% percussion. You know, it really is very percussive. So it has melody and these kind of ostinato rhythms. And of course, the Bowron loves that and the Bones love that as well. So we began to, I think we really found each other initially through that. And actually, when I came back from CalArts in 1991, 92, we were doing a music network tour, one of those wonderful tours, and myself and Micheál were doing it. We were doing it throughout the country, and Micheál said to me, why don't we make a piece of music together? Because up to that time, I'd been playing with Micheál for a long time, of course, but I absolutely loved it, but we had never composed a piece together. And most of the music Micheál was playing at that time were actually his arrangements of traditional material. So I actually set about making a piece for North Indian tabla, and I made the rhythms and taught them to Micheál, and I taught them to him he played the little African imbira. And that piece was called Must Be More Crispy, and which is based on actually South Indian and North Indian rhythmic structures. Micheál then lost that imbira, would you believe? And that was the last we ever heard of him playing the imbira and he translated that from his thumbs actually into his two hands onto the piano, and then he made the musical side of this, and that's what became then Must Be More Crispy, or as it became to be known then, just Crispy.
Must Be More Crispy. That's Micheál O'Sullivan, Mel Mercier and the Irish Chamber Orchestra. And Mel Mercier is my guest tonight, picking all the tracks, and we're going to have more from Mel after this break. And this is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM, the Sunday night special where we get someone to pick the tracks. And tonight it is Mel Mercier, who is Professor of Performing Arts at UL. He's also a Bowron player and of some renown. He specialises in his teaching, that is, in traditional music, Irish traditional music, ethnomusicology, Javanese gamelan, Indian classical music, dance drumming from Ghana, and all sorts. And so far we've been talking about his work with Micheál O'Sullivan, his dad's work with the Chieftains and Cúil Tóirí Cúualainn and all the rest of it. And we're going to move on now to a period in time when Mel was minding his own business at home and the phone rings and it's John Cage. And it wasn't silence either. What was he after?
Well, we didn't know who John Cage was. My father didn't know. I certainly didn't know. I mean, I often say, and I don't want to do anybody any disrespect, but I'm pretty sure nobody in our street knew who John Cage was at that time. But John Cage was actually ringing from RTE, and he was ringing to ask my father if he would come in to RTE to do some recording on the Bowron, that he wanted as part of a piece of music he was making called Roratorio, an Irish circus on Finnegan's Wake, which was basically a new piece of music that John had been commissioned to make by German radio. And it was based on Joyce's Finnegan's Wake. What John had done was he'd gone through Finnegan's Wake in a couple of different ways. One was to pull out all of the references to any kind of sound. And he found all of those sounds through in Ireland, but also in different archives throughout the world. He also went through it to underline all of the places that were named. And on his trip to Ireland that time, he travelled around the country to all of those places with his sound engineer, a guy called John Fullman. And they just went wherever the place was mentioned. John took out his microphone and they recorded whatever happened in that place. So you can imagine that could be anything from a motorbike to the sound of birds to the sound of water, sound of people chatting, anything, in fact, that was going on at the time. And the third thing was there's music mentioned. And John wanted to have traditional Irish musicians also as part of this, what was to be a radio piece. And so he had been in touch with RTE, and Ciarán MacMahóna had given him some names. And on that list was Seamus Ennis and Paddy Glacken and Matt Malloy. Joe Heaney, the wonderful Shannon singer, Merce Cunningham and John Cage already knew in New York. And also on that list was my father's name. Now, actually, at that time, I thought it was just my father's name. But just last week, I saw an image of a page of John Cage's own diary before that time. And written on it is, on his list of musicians, is Pather Mercier or Mel Mercier, brackets, his son.
Oh.
So I was thrilled to see that. But of course, my father beat him to that, and because it wasn't either or.
Both.
And so when my father spoke to John on the phone, he said, can I bring my son Mel in? And so we went in, and we assumed that we would be meeting some of the other traditional musicians to sit around and play some jigs and reels, but none of them were there. It was just John Cage and his sound engineer. And John invited us to go into the studio and to sit to play together, myself and my father, which, of course, was wonderful for us because we had been doing that for some time. And in 1979, my father was already 3 years gone from the Chieftains. He left in 1976. But this was like a whole new world, a whole new universe kind of opened up for him. And I tagged along with him. So we sat down. And we just did what we used to do at home in the sitting room, which is my father say, oh, let's play I Am a Jolly Beggarman. And he'd go, I am a jolly beggarman. The doodle-light, the drum. And we would just we just play along and kind of knock off each other and improvise a little. And then he'd say, oh, well, now we'll just play a jig. And my father would launch into a jig. Or he'd say, let's play Ham Butter and Eggs. And Ham Butter and Eggs was the first rhythm that my father learnt from Sean O'Riordan. When O'Riordan was telling him the kind of things he wanted him to play in that original play that he brought my father in to do. And so O'Riordan had taught my father this rhythm that went ham butter and eggs, ham butter and eggs, ham butter and rasher and sausage and eggs. And so my father, dee-yattle-dee-dum. And we would just play that and we'd make the most of it for as long as we could. And we recorded it. We didn't meet any of the other musicians. And then that was added in, that recording and the recording of Matt Malloy and Paddy Glacken and the others and Joe Heaney. That was added into the 3,000 other sounds that John had collected. And sitting then right in the middle of it was John's own voice, reading what he called misostics, which are words taken from Finnegan's Wake, but not in the order they're written, but actually taking the name James Joyce and taking the first word that had a J in it, the next word that had an A, and reading his misostics in this extraordinary kind of heightened kind of speech. And so this became Roratory. It's about 59 minutes long.
And we're going to play a bit of it. Because this I mean this in the best possible sense, because I actually love this music. It's a head wreck. In a good way.
Yeah, it was. I mean,
it is a head wreck.
Yeah, I mean, you can imagine, of course, that not long after we had that experience, we got a call from John to invite us to go to the Georges Pompidou Centre in Paris, to IRCAM, into the underground studios where they were actually doing a live performance of this. And on that occasion, it was just myself and my father, John Cage and Joe Heaney. And that was an extraordinary moment in my life. I mean, to walk into IRCAM was extraordinary. I mean, this was the experimental space of Pierre Boulez at that time, of avant-garde music. Now, again, I had no idea who Pierre Boulez was. But I know that I met him at some point in time, and all of these other up-and-coming, extraordinary, cutting-edge French composers and composers from different parts of the world during that time. But we performed it for the first time. And the other dimension of it in live performance is that John Fullman then set up some 50 speakers in different parts of the space. So these sounds were coming through, or these 3,000 sounds were coming at different times through all of these different speakers. So it was a totally immersive experience. And we sat there, not with a set list, but with a stopwatch. And John said, Pather and Mel, you just play for 20 minutes. Divide it up as you wish throughout the hour and just come in and play. Don't play at the same time as Joe Heaney, or subsequently when Paddy Glacken was there, don't play along with Paddy. And we're like, well, hold on a second now. This really turned our world upside down, because, of course, the whole point of traditional music is to play together. John was telling us not to play together, just to sit in. So the Bowron in that case was just like the sound of the opera singer that they caught somewhere, or the sound of that motorbike, or the blackbird. And sometimes the sonic texture was incredibly dense, where you could hardly hear anything. You couldn't distinguish one thing from another. And then suddenly it would die away, and you might just hear the Bowrons on their own, or you might just hear Joe Heaney's extraordinary voice.
Okay, here's the beginning of Roratorio, John Cage. Music there from John Cage from Roratorio, and Mel Mercier is my guest tonight. Picked that piece of music, not least because it's John Cage, it's that, but he's also playing on it, as is your dad, Pater Mercier, and all those other Irish musicians. I know some of them, spoke to them about that period, you know, and they said initially some of them thought that Cage was just crazy. You know, they thought, what's he talking about? But they said as time went on, they thought, oh, this is amazing.
That's right. Well, the other musicians that, we did it for 10 years, in fact, so it was with Liam O'Flynn and Seamus Tansey.
Matt Malloy.
Well, Matt was on
the... He was on the recording.
He was on the original, but actually Matt, I think, was quite busy with the Chieftains at that time. So it was Seamus Tansey and myself and my father and Paddy Glacken. And then for a while after Joe Heaney died, Noreen Irene actually did it once with us as well. But at a certain point in time, Merce Cunningham, the choreographer and dancer, who was John's partner professionally and personally, he made a wonderful, wonderful dance with his company. And so we actually toured with that. We played at the Albert Hall, for example, and we played many places in Europe as well. And that was absolutely extraordinary, because... Merce created this beautiful dance. Just like hearing the music for the first time and being involved in was like my sort of entree or introduction to a whole other world of the avant-garde. Seeing the Merce Cunningham Dance Company was the first time I'd ever seen contemporary dance as well. And I suppose between the two of them, they made me certainly listen to sound in a different way. And to see movement in a different way, but also maybe more significantly made me realize that anything is possible. Mm. And I think that had a very profound impact on me.
It's incredible stuff. And you could talk about someone like John Cage all night, because I think if you are into music and you don't know him, it's worth checking not just his music out, but things he said about music. Because as you say, it does change your entire approach to sound. And, you know, if you're the sort of person who, say, goes to a gym and you're listening to terrible music coming through the speakers, you actually might get more pleasure listening to the sound of the whirring machines beside you.
Oh, yeah.
Which actually might be a more pleasant sound to listen to if you actually adjust your brain a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I you know, make a lot of music for theatre. And some people say that most of my soundscapes actually sound like those whirring machines, or the hum of the air conditioner,
yeah,
or the fridge in your kitchen, which of course has a sound life all of its own.
When you are commissioned, as you are often now, to write for the theatre, how does that work? Because you presumably need to know what the play is about and what the words are and how it works, but I don't know at what point you're contacted. How does that normally happen?
Yeah, it depends, John. Sometimes you get a call quite late. You might get a call just a few months before a show goes into rehearsal. And in that case, what happens is you go and you usually meet the director. And I love to have those initial conversations with a director. And to be perfectly honest, I didn't admit this for years, but I have started to admit it now. I generally will avoid reading the play. Mm-hmm. I sometimes will just find out enough about it so that when I go to meet the director that I have some sense of enough to kind of hang the conversation on and that I don't look completely stupid. But mostly I don't like to read the play too early because I find it gets in the way.
Mm-hmm.
I'm much more interested in hearing what the director imagines the production will be, because I've always felt that I'm not writing music or creating music for a play, I'm creating music for a production. And it's not until the actors start to sound the text, and that's often where I will meet the text for the first time, is in on that first day of rehearsals, where there's generally a read through, and so the cast will read it, and then it immediately comes to life for me.
And when you start to create actual sounds,
yeah,
what do you use to create those sounds? Does that vary, or do you begin as a lot of people would at a keyboard?
No, I don't. I begin in different ways. Usually, what happens is I like to just let the information that comes through those initial conversations, I just like to let it percolate. And I like to let kind of notions come to me. So, and they'd be things like about the kind of general colour or the tone of the piece. And that might translate itself into a notion that, gosh, you know, I'd be kind of curious about maybe using a cello in this piece, or maybe some saxophone, or hurdy-gurdy, or whatever might, or glass harmonica. And so I let that happen. I trust that instinct. Then I tend to go into the studio and I will work with some musicians to generate some material, to make some sounds. I won't go in to make any music as such. I won't go in to make any pieces. I'll go in to make some sounds, and then I will usually gather together sounds recorded, and also sounds from my own archive of sounds, some found sounds, some natural sounds, and I start to make what I often describe as just a palette of colours, a palette of sounds. Because when I go into the theatre then, and it's at that point where the actors are on the stage, when there's movement, when there's light, when there's a set, that's really when the piece actually starts to emerge, and that's when I begin to paint. So it's a real dialogue.
You say you're painting.
Yeah, I feel like, yeah, I always feel like I'm painting. So you go into a space with a palette of colours that you just hope will work. It's a little bit like when you go to paint a room in your house and you go and buy some paint. And you kind of know that until it's on the wall, you don't know whether it's going to work or not, whether it's going to ping, whether it's going to sing. And so when I go in with a palette of sounds, I might, at a certain point in time, when I feel that there's a certain, let's say, atmosphere starting to come together, I will try to paint into that. So I'll try a colour, I'll try a sound. It could be a simple drone sound. And if it sticks, and this is really what, then I know I'm in. And once that space opens out, then I start to feed other colours in and I start to paint. Because I'm not the kind of theatre composer who's interested in just creating the music between scenes. I mean, I've done that. A lot of theatre composition is that. I'm much, much, much more interested in weaving sound through the voice and working with the light. Music in the theatre in that way, or soundscapes, for example, for me at least, the way I work, cannot be pre-made. You can't make it beforehand because you don't know what you're making until it starts to come together. And so that's why I think of it often as painting. So I'm looking for the kind of emotional or the psychological undercurrents.
Does that mean then, practically, you have to be there every night and kind of perform the soundtrack live?
What it means is that I need to be there a lot in the rehearsal period and in what we call the technical period, which is really where the sound and light and movement and action and choreography, where they come together. If I'm making a soundscape that's recorded, then by opening night, I have generally finished that.
Sure.
And it's recorded and it's played back as it is. And I like to work, John, in every space in a different way. So I like to work with sound coming from different sources. I think a lot of this, for example, comes out of my experience of John Cage, because I just realize now that I'm describing Roratorio in a way, because I fell in love with the sound of the spoken word, of the voice, and kind of rich sonic landscapes, and the immersive experience of that when I was doing Roratorio. And I think I've spent the last 20 years or so trying to recreate that in all of the in all of the theatre work that I've done.
Can we play a track now from your release, Testament, which has come from your theatre work? So just briefly explain what the CD is.
Yeah, so the CD is a compilation of really recomposition. So I took material from 9 shows that I've worked on over the years, and I went into the studio with those materials, which for any particular show it might be an hour of materials over an hour and a half period, and I distilled it down to make, you know, 2 to 5 minute tracks. The challenge was to make something that worked outside of the kind of very ephemeral context of the theatre space, because it only happens when it happens. And music and sound are very much just part of the whole. So taking it out and into the studio to make it stand on its own, as music alone, really was the challenge here.
We're going to play a Power Book, is that okay? Power Book? So tell me a little bit about that.
So Power Book is a book that was written by the British author Jeanette Winterson. And the book was taken by Deborah Warner and Fiona Shaw, and made into a theatrical piece, and it was performed by Fiona Shaw and Saffron Burrows, and I made the music for it. And the play itself was a series of vignettes, really about love. It's really all about love, and I made this particular track, which comes pretty directly out of the original production, which is the story of Lancelot and Guinevere.
My name is Lancelot.
Okay, and that was the Power Book there from Mel, your own release. That's on the Heresy label, isn't it? Heresy, yeah. Fine
that's
label.
Fine yeah,
label.
Very fine label.
Some I great
mean,
stuff.
Wonderful eclectic mix. And Eric Fradd does a fantastic job. Beautifully produced as well.
One of the things I should have said earlier when we were talking about the great Mercier name is your brother Paul, who's well known in his own right as a director, filmmaker, all the rest.
Yeah. I mean, Paul really introduced me and my family to theatre. There's no real theatre in our family before Paul. I mean, I think my father was probably quite theatrical in his own right, but it was Paul, particularly through his work with the Passion Machine, that he really showed us the magic of theatre. And we absolutely loved his plays. I mean, we were always very, very moved by them. He, of course, made some extraordinary theatre work, brought a whole generation of a new audience to theatre because of his Dublin-based vernacular work. and of course worked with an extraordinary generation of actors, for whom he is beloved, actually. I always meet actors who are just in awe of him, as indeed I am myself. I haven't had that many opportunities to work with him since I came later to theatre, to be perfectly honest. I still feel like a bit of an interloper. Paul really is the theatre genius. And I've only had a chance to work with him a couple of times, but he invited me to do music for an Irish language play that he wrote called Setanta, which was with Fee Bean. In Connemara, and it's based on the Cú Chulainn story and the bull, but set in the world of competitive wrestling, and so that's also one of the tracks that I've included on the album. And just as with the Power Book track, which features Fiona Shaw's voice, this also features the voices of two of the actors who are on the show.
All right, let's hear that one, actually.
Thomas couldn't bit.
Setanta, their music from Mel Mercier and Paul Mercier, your brother. So, I mean, what a family. Any more artists in the family of 10?
Oh, they're all artists.
Every one of them.
They're all artists, yeah, definitely.
Wow. Hard to keep up, I'd imagine. Now, you mentioned earlier on gamelan.
Yeah.
And you went to Java to get the gamelan for Cork. What was the purpose of... And I'm not being smart when I ask this question, yeah. But... Why did Cork need a gamelan? You know what I mean? It's a massive, complex thing from a completely different culture. Mm. And you bring it over as a kind of what's become a sort of a centrepiece of UL. I say Cork, sorry, I meant UL.
Well, both actually, John.
Was it
yeah, the first one came to Cork.
Oh, there's
and
two
then,
now, is there?
Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
Right, okay.
Well, yeah. I'll tell you that story. Yeah.
Well, the one I know about in UL, it's the centrepiece kind of the place, you know, in lots of ways. And everybody knows about it. Yeah. But originally, how did you, what's the word, justify the need for a gamelan in Cork and later in UL?
I'm not sure how I justified it. I think I was just passionate about it and maybe quite persuasive. I knew it would work. And when the gamelan did arrive, we stood back from it. There was a huge pile of newspapers, Indonesian newspapers, that the instruments had been wrapped in. And the instrument sat on the floor, and it had an aura. It had an energy about it, and there was a kind of reluctance to step into it. And then, but we did, and I taught the group a piece of music that I'd heard at the court in Yogyakarta in Central Java, and I taught that traditional music for many years. We brought artists over from Indonesia via the Indonesian embassy in London, dancers and musicians. And bit by bit, I began to realise that this room full of extraordinary gongs and metallophones and two-eared fiddle, that this was a room that was full of potential for me as well as a composer. And so I began to work with the students to make new music. And I was inspired to do that by my knowledge of new music for Javanese gamelan in Java itself, where there is a whole wonderful experimental world of new music and dance, and people using the instruments and the sounds in entirely new and contemporary ways. And so I took my license from that in a way.
Now, see, my understanding, Mel, of gamelan is that all the instruments together is the instrument as such. Is that correct? It's not a series of instruments. The series of instruments is the instrument.
Correct. So you've got a room full of maybe 50 different instruments, but they're all tuned together. So you've got large hanging gongs, got very, very low bass sounds, and then you've got these small little metallophones that have a little bit more like kind of piccolo, the equivalent of the piccolo in the orchestra. So you've got like five octaves, and it's played by an ensemble. It's quintessential ensemble music. It's all about listening. It's very democratic music. It's not like a band, like a kind of typical band where you've got a lead singer and then the band behind and your percussion, etc. This every part is kind of equal in it. And it's a little bit like a kind of this kind of multi-dimensional kind of Rubik's cube or mosaic, where every sound has its place and it's beautifully balanced. The traditional music is beautifully balanced, I think. The tuning, of course, is entirely different to anything that we're familiar with. So if you bring a piano, for example, into the Schomer Gamelan or the Gamelan Room, either in UL or in UCC, that piano will be completely out of tune with the Gamelan. Right. Or the other way around. And so they're two different worlds, in fact. They are two different worlds. And the other interesting thing is that no two gamelans are tuned the same.
Really?
Yeah, so every gamelan sounds different. It's only really in tune with itself. And that's why the Javanese say that they have their own personality. And so gamelans are given names. For example, the beautiful name of the Cork gamelan is Nyai Sekar Madhu Sari, which means venerable flower of honey essence. And that's a name given to it by the maker and by one of the senior musicians. The UL one is called Sekar Aram, fragrant flower. And the Cork one, for example, is considered to be female. It has it because the sense of when it was first played in Java was that it has a female energy.
We're going to hear the Cork one now, right? The Cork Gamelan Ensemble.
That's
with
right.
Irla O'Leonard. So here's two worlds again.
This is two worlds, yeah. A lot of the work that I've done with the Cork Gamelan Ensemble, which is now the Irish Gamelan Orchestra, has been to collaborate, to bring artists into the Gamelan Room. So people like Julie Feeney, for example, or Kate Ellis and Nick Roth, and in this case, Irla O'Leonard. And Irla came in and he found this old bardic text about the three forges and the kind of the forging of knowledge. And of course, the gamelan itself is made in a forge. So we brought those two worlds together and created this particular piece.
And that was Irla O'Leonard there with the Cork Gamelan Ensemble and the Three Forges. You mentioned, actually, and I'm going to speed things up now, Mel, because we're coming towards the end of the programme, but I want to get a couple more tracks in. You mentioned Kate Ellis a moment ago, and earlier on you mentioned Niall Vallely, and I see both of them figure here in your next choice. Sundas, tell me about Sundas.
Sundas is, I suppose, I wanted to pull out a piece of music that represented really contemporary Irish composition.
Is there plenty of that happening?
There's so much of that happening, John. It's an extraordinarily exciting time in terms of new music making in Ireland. And, you know, led by many people, but amongst them, of course, the Crash Ensemble. And indeed, Kate Ellis, who is at the helm there now, and with whom I've worked often, and I was in UCC with Niall Vallely. He is a really, really exciting composer, working from inside, from right inside traditional music, and he wrote a piece for Kate for solo cello, but with tape. So it's a terribly contemporary piece. It's very, very beautiful. And I suppose I also want to bring it here because one of the things that has been developing in UL over the last couple of years is an increasing interest in composition and creative music practices. We had Kate down to talk to us really about new music and the making of new music in Ireland today. And she said a very interesting thing to me in the taxi on the way to get the train home. She said, you know, a lot of the young 20-something creative musicians in Dublin who are making new music, who might have been called composers in the past, no longer think of themselves as composers because their practices are so diverse now, and it's across disciplines. They're working with dancers, they're working with visuals, and also they're not necessarily writing down the music, they're not necessarily using notation. And we've just, in fact, launched a new master's degree in composition that really captures all of that at UL. So it will bring in, really, for the first time, traditional musicians and classical musicians and jazz musicians into the same space to make new music.
This is Sundas for Kate Ellis and Niall Vallely. K Kate Ellis, Niall Vallely there, and Sandas. Mel Mercier is my guest tonight. We're coming up towards his last choice. Mel, just before we play your last choice, where do you think it's all going to go? Because you couldn't have imagined, I suspect, when you came back from your studies in America and, you know, okay, it worked with John Cage and all the rest of it. But, you know, as professor of performing arts at UL, so many musicians are passing through, and you've seen so many over the years now. Things seem to be extraordinarily healthy, and the attitude to music seems to be very healthy. I might be wrong, but it seems people are less inclined to climb into a box nowadays and say, this is what I do and I don't do that. Am I right on that?
I think that's right. I mean, the two things that seem to me to define the current kind of wave of music making in Ireland are the appetite for collaboration. And I think that's been perhaps around for a little while. But when you mix that with the appetite for working across the arts, in a kind of interdisciplinary way, and the cross-cultural, cross-cultural to that, you have a new kind of paradigm, I think, a new mix. That seems to me to be terribly exciting. What Micheál called actually between worlds and sort of on the edge of many, many things. And that's certainly where I like to locate myself when I can. It's also the space where I like to try and encourage those around me, particularly my students, for example, who I have the privilege to work with, to try and encourage them to move out of the centres, what we sometimes call their comfort zones, but to move out of the centres and to move towards the edges. And I think that's the future.
Mel, thanks a million for coming in, and thanks for being so generous with your time. Because this is complex stuff that you're talking about, and it's great to get an opportunity to hear. Well, hear the professor. You won't let me use the word master. The professor, to hear the professor talking about it. Your last musical choice, because one of the things as a result of the nature of our conversation tonight is we completely ignored the fact that you also, you know, listen to all sorts of other stuff and have done, and we probably should have played T-Rex right at the beginning. Mm. But your last choice is Kate Nana McGarrigle.
Yeah.
Heart Like a Wheel.
Yeah, this is an album, the McGarrigle Sisters, that probably is closest to the heart, I suppose, of my family. The album is amongst those many that my father brought back from his trips to America and to Europe, and he introduced us to lots of different artists, like Lyser Godek, for example, from Brittany, the Silly Sisters, Rita and Sarah Kane, a lot of female duets, in fact.
Yeah.
And so the Kate and Anna McGarrigle, this particular song, I think, as well, when I went back to listen to them, this is the one that really, really goes into my heart. I made a radio documentary for the radio Orty documentary in one series a few years ago about my father, and I interviewed all of my siblings for that. And my sister Claire said a wonderful thing. She said that, you know, when they were growing up, they're a bit younger than me. All of this traditional music stuff, all of this diddly idle, I think that she might have even called it, meant nothing to them. But when Daddy came home from his trips abroad with these very exotic gifts, sometimes clothes, and then these extraordinary albums, and this album in particular, Kate and Anna McGarrigle, then it all began to make sense for them. And so in a way, this is perhaps the our family song.
Mel Mercier, thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast of Mystery Train with John Kelly. Mystery Train hits the rails every Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on 96 to 99 RTE Lyric FM.